Up next with Michael Tellinger, some startling conclusions about the origins of humankind. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Michael Tellinger is a scientist in the very true sense of the word, never shying away from controversial issues and scrutinizing every clue. He's very meticulous, by the way. After a 30-year-long obsession with the origins of humankind and the genetic anomalies of our species, he wrote Slave Species of God. When Johann Hein exposed the mystery of the stone ruins of South Africa to Michael in 2007, they began an irreversible process of research that then led Michael into more startling scientific conclusions and then the completion of two more works, Adam's Calendar and The Temples of African Gods. Here live is Michael Tellinger. Michael, how are you?
Excellent, George. Nice to be talking to you again after quite a while.
It's coming up on 2 years. I can't believe it.
I know. It's amazing how time flies when you're having fun and up and down the mountains looking at ancient stones, you know.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Johannesburg. I'm actually visiting a friend of mine in Johannesburg. I had to come up for some meetings. So I'm out of the mountains where I've moved to about 2 years ago, just before you and I last spoke. I had just moved into the mountains of Mpumalanga, where most of these ancient ruins are concentrated. And I've been doing most of my research there. But at the moment I'm in Johannesburg.
Well, it's incredible, though. Technology is, I mean, there you are there. I just left Los Angeles. I'm now in the Midwest in St. Louis. And we're carrying on this conversation on 540 radio stations, streaming on the Internet. It's just amazing the way this all works.
Well, I'm glad you guys have got all those bases covered because I wouldn't know where to begin.
All you have to do is do what you do well. We'll do the rest for you.
Excellent.
Tell me about your latest work, Temples of the African Gods. And how does that relate to your previous two works?
Thanks, George. It really is quite a fascinating sequence of events that's unfolding. And I must admit, I'm probably one of the luckiest explorers or scientists in the world right now. When I first released Slave Species of God in 2006, I never realized that work, which deals with the slave species certain scenario. I heard some of the inserts in between waiting to talk to you, talking about how the world is becoming more and more enslaved, mm-hmm. and how people have just really become clones and drones for the Illuminati and so forth. And it's just amazing to see how my first book, Slave Species of God, how that is becoming more and more true and accurate as time goes by. And that information and that work then led to the discovering of or meeting Johann Heine, who came to one of my talks and presentations on the slave species, and he said to me, "Listen, I've got to show you some stuff that I've been photographing for the past 20 years," and he started showing me these incredible aerial photographs of these circular stone structures along the mountaintops of southern Africa. And it just blew my mind. And I instinctively knew that somehow those structures were linked to these early, very, very early civilizations of Homo sapiens on Earth. And very shortly after that, Johann then showed me what he discovered. He didn't know its significance was what we now call Adam's Calendar. Now, we now know that it is probably the oldest man-made structure on Earth. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. monolithic calendar. And then when we realize that the calendar, which is incidentally still accurate today, it still works accurately.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's just spectacular. And I think once the world realizes what there is here, it suddenly makes Stonehenge and the pyramids are impressive, but just the sheer find of this calendar site at this point in time, I think it's going to cause a stampede. George, I must tell you, when I take people to Adam's Calendar, it changes their lives. You can see their lives have changed. It is quite dramatic.
It hits them. It finally hits them that there's something more than they've ever been taught before, Michael.
Exactly. And that's, it's a very dangerous situation because you're not quite sure what to tell people. So I no longer just take any kind of tourists there. I only do what I call now you know, specialized tours of people that are broad-minded, that are spiritually awake, that are consciously connected, and so forth. And we take those people there who want to know, they're hungry for more information, and you can just throw anything at them, and they are okay with it. Otherwise, you know, if you get a bunch of tourists and they come there and say, "Well, when I see those big rocks, you know," it doesn't quite work. You know,
how many other explorers over time have shown an interest in these stone ruins?
That's a very interesting story. I'm gonna come back to that in a minute if I can. Just to finish how these discoveries link to my work, my first book. It's just really a continuation, and it basically what it does. It for the first time uncovers this vanished civilization, vast, very very vast vanished civilization that lived at the southernmost tip of Africa, of South Africa and Zimbabwe mostly, that were mining gold. It is the civilization that many, many hundreds, if not thousands of authors have written about for decades upon decades, including Zachariah Sitchin, the brilliant Zachariah Sitchin, and many others. But no one has ever had the physical proof and evidence to substantiate all those writings. And this is for the first time, our discoveries for the first time really substantiate and provide the physical evidence for all the work that has been done by so many brilliant people in the past. And that's what I find absolutely extremely exciting, and I feel very fortunate that I'm, you know, involved in this process. And really, it's my work and Jan Heine's discoveries over the last 20 years that have now finally reached the world. And thanks to people like you, that we're getting the message across.
Well, it's exciting, and as you know, Zachariah Sitchin believes that the Anunnaki settled through Iraq, perhaps in part of that region in South Africa as well, to mine for gold, just like you've said.
Yeah, that's it. And that's it. So to come back to your next question, George, is how many people have shown interest in these ruins? That in itself is a fascinating story, which the world does not know.
All right. Let's find out. Go ahead.
The fascination with the ruins, the vanished civilizations in South Africa, goes back to the late 1800s already, with the first Portuguese settlers that came around the Cape. The Cape of Storms, or the Cape of Good Hope, as it's called, the southern tip of Africa. And they started settling and exploring the inner land. And they were known as the degradados, the sort of great unwashed. They would take them out of prison and send them out to explore the, you know, give them an option. Do you want to be a prisoner or do you want to be an explorer kind of thing? If they didn't come back, nobody lost any sleep. But fortunately, there's one particular guy called Antonio Fernandez in 1510 already, who went and explored from the Mozambican side the inner lands of Africa, southern Africa. And he came back with fascinating stories of ancient ruins and giant stone walls that were completely ruined and overgrown. Nobody was living in it. The people that lived close by, the indigenous people, the native people, didn't know who built those ruins or who built those structures. And in fact, he's got it on record saying that when he asked the people that lived nearby, incidentally, those people that he met were called the Karanga or the Makaranga people, which means children of the sun. All right. Now, and that already brings in a huge mystery, because they weren't supposed to be sun worshipping cultures in southern Africa at that stage. That was all assigned to the northern hemisphere, to Egypt and, you know, those ancient civilizations. So suddenly he comes across the children of the sun, who didn't know where their name really came from and didn't know who built these ancient ruins. And he's got it on record when they said that it must have been done by the devil, because man cannot build such structures. And then by 1891, in the mid-1800s, there were a number of explorers that came through southern Africa studying these ruins. The one that sticks out for me is the brilliant Theodore Bent. He's a British archaeologist that mm-hmm. did a lot of work. He did a lot of work in the Near East, the Middle East, and in Egypt. And then he came down south, and he spent a number of years here traveling through South Africa and Zimbabwe. He was the first guy to really excavate Great Zimbabwe, which we now know from a lot of research that it probably was Enki's headquarters and his head office. And it's part of this ancient civilizations and all these ancient stone structures. It was the mine manager's house. When you travel, I don't know what your mine fields look like in the United States, but in South Africa, the mining towns are normally these small little towns with the people living in the houses around the mine, and the mine manager always lives in a big house on the hill. And nothing has changed. Enki had the big house on the hill. That's pretty much what it comes down to, yeah?
In what time period do you think this might have been, Michael? Because Sitchin, I think, writes 400,000 years ago. Would you echo that? Or that seems like you would, okay.
Well, there are actually two time periods here, George. The first time period is the arrival of the Anunnaki 400,000 years ago. And then there's the actual settlement of the Southern African mine fields, and then starting the cloning process of the new species, the primitive species, the Lulu Amelu and the primitive worker. And it seems to me from current research that we're looking at about 285,000 years when this primitive species was first cloned, the Homo sapiens. And that would also echo the findings of genetic engineering when the first Homo sapiens appeared on Earth around 300,000 years ago.
Truly, it is probably one of the greatest stories of mankind.
It truly is. And it really, you know, what it does for me, it gives me a great sense of understanding. And it's when you start to understand this thing, which I call the great human puzzle, once the pieces of the puzzle start to fit in and you start to see the picture emerge out of this murky, you know, historic, murky sequence of events, it just becomes so exciting when you can place yourself in this great story and start to get a sense and understanding who you are and where you belong and where you come from and why this world is so confusing today.
Has anybody else, along with you and the people that you've just mentioned, really seen the true importance? Do they truly understand what these stone ruins really mean?
Yeah, that is the saddest part of our work at the moment. I must tell you that in South Africa, there is from the authorities side and from the established academia, there is a huge move to discredit what we are doing. They're just not getting it. They just don't get it.
Why are they trying to do that? For political reasons?
Yeah, I guess there's a very strong political motive here. You know, we've gone from apartheid to the opposite situation, where there's a very strong group of black elite politicians who have just taken control. And this is not a racist accusation. This is just, you know, this is a fact. So we've gone from a white extremist to a black extremist situation. I don't want to get too involved in the politics because it's not as bad as it sounds, but it is bad enough to affect people like me and the work that we're doing.
Well, we know, for example, Michael, that good researchers like Zahi Hawass will not listen to any other alternative story about the pyramids of Egypt. When you tell him the possibilities are extraterrestrials helped them or they had high technology, he won't listen to it. And he's very close-minded when it comes to that. I suspect that they're doing the same thing in South Africa.
Yeah, there's a very strong sense of Bantu entitlement at the moment. And I'd like to make that my last political statement because already I'm not well liked and I don't want to make it any worse. But what I'm sad about is that we're presenting the indigenous people of Southern Africa with the greatest story that anyone could ever present them with. To say that this is where the first humans on Earth emerged, and everyone else on Earth is a direct derivative of this first great civilization that lived here. The Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Mayans, the Olmecs, that every civilization originates here. And we see that in the symbols, we see that in the cultures, in the agriculture, we see it in everything we see. The original settlements were here in South Africa and Zimbabwe. And that's a fantastic story to share with the world, that the first civilization on Earth were African.
Was the Garden of Eden there in that region?
That's a good question, and I think it probably has two answers. I think a portion of the Garden of Eden was here, because what we now know as well, George, is the reason why Adam's calendar is so extremely important and why there is so much energy at the calendar site itself. Remember, it's right on the edge of a cliff. It looks out over what's known as the Barberton Valley, the Barberton Impact Crater, where the richest gold mine on Earth still is today, Sheba Gold Mine. You know, Queen of Sheba, Sheba Gold Mine. Maybe they knew something we don't when they called it Sheba Gold Mine. The reason I say that there was probably a Garden of Eden here and in Mesopotamia is because it is at Adam's calendar that they cloned, they actually inserted the first fertilized eggs of this new species, Homo sapien, into the first Anunnaki females to carry the new beings. And be their surrogate mothers. And we read that in the Sumerian tablets. Zechariah Sitchin speaks about the first seven Anunnaki birth goddesses or birth mothers. And then we hear an echo of that in Hinduism, the seven birth goddesses and so forth. And then you also, in modern genetics, you hear the seven, you know, seven something of Eve. What are they called again? Seven daughters of Eve
seven daughters.
So forth. Yeah. So... And it seems that Adam's calendar is where they performed that first ritual and the actual insemination.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and that is why Adam's calendar is such an important site. And there's so much energy there than when people that have got strong psychic abilities come in there, they go absolutely crazy. And they start telling you things that they've never imagined they'd be telling you. And I must tell you that I've learned probably more from psychics and psychic revelations going to Adam's calendar than I've learned from scientific research. And strangely enough, all the psychic predictions or that I'm told eventually tie up with what we find with scientific research afterwards.
Explain the calendar a little bit more for us. Kind of paint us a picture of it.
Okay. It's right on the edge of a cliff. It sits pretty much on 31 degrees east longitudinal line, which is perfectly in line with Great Zimbabwe, the main site of Great Zimbabwe, and the Great Pyramid of Giza, 31 degrees east.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, the numeric value for the biblical Elohim is original numeric value is 31. Remember that Hebrew and the old classic languages were based on a numeric system. Each letter had a value, and they didn't just make up words like we make slang words today. You know, that's why our language doesn't have any power or any energy. The original languages were structured around words and the power and the value in the word. So every word had a numeric value, and the word Elohim, that value was 31. Maybe they were trying to tell us something once again.
Yeah. Maybe.
And now,
when you see it's up there on the cliffs, how big is it?
It was originally a circular structure. It's, now I have a complete memory block, but it is probably, about 20 meters across.
Oh, it's huge then.
You know, it's reasonably large, yeah. The original circular structure. And then you have, right in the center, you have the two main monoliths. For people who want to look at this, incidentally, they can just go to our foundation's website, which is makomati.org. That's makomati.org.
I'll make sure we get a link up there at Coast to Coast for you, Michael.
At least your listeners have a very good look at it to see how it's just so beautiful. It moves me physically every time I look at that picture. I've seen it a million times, and every time I look at it, it still moves me. Anyway, so in the middle, you got these two large monoliths, calendar stones. The one stone is actually the calendar stone itself. And the other stone, which is on the western side, is the stone that casts the shadow on the calendar stone, which allows us to tell every day of the year.
Michael, we're going to take this quick break and come right back and talk more about this. We'll be back. Well, webmaster Lex Lonehood already has the link for you on the makomati.org website, so you can see this stone ruins we're talking about, Adam's calendar. It's on our Twitter feed, and it'll also be included in the show recap at the end of the program, but you can find it right now at our Twitter feed, direct link to that website as well. That's time for our traditional shout-out, and thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. First of all, those of you listening to your favorite radio stations across North America, hello to you, including our brand-new listeners to WOR 710 AM in New York that all joined us this week, Streamlink members, XM Satellite, and the various chat rooms and groups, the NighthawkZone.com folks, hello to you, Imaginative Worlds, Into Infinity, National Radio Club, Sorcery, IRC, the MySpace groups, the Twitter groups, the Yahoo Chats, the Northern Kentucky Paranormal Group, Above Top Secret, the SoCal UFO Meetup Group, and of course the Hollywood Ghost Hunters. Thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, it's more with Michael Tellinger and his incredible story and research on Coast to Coast AM. And tonight we're with scientist and researcher Michael Tellinger. Michael, let's get back to the Adam's calendar and the stone ruins, and you were describing how they look like. We've got that link for you up already so people can take a look at this. But this is incredible. What was the calendar's intent? What was it supposed to be up there for?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think it was originally like a very significant ceremonial site established or built for the arrival of the Anunnaki here in southern Africa, and Enki establishing his great city, this extensively large, the largest stone city or settlement ever built on planet Earth. And when you start looking at it from satellite photographs, it truly takes your breath away for the size of it and the extent of it. And I think Adam's calendar was the flagship and the centerpiece of this settlement here in southern Africa in the middle of the first gold mines on planet Earth. And not only that, it was also, that's why, because of its importance and its significance, this is where they then cloned and did the first the actual insemination or the fertilization of the Anunnaki females and started the birthing process of this new species called Homo sapien.
The remarkable. Yeah. I want you to weave a story for us, Michael. Some of it may be based on, I think, your gut feelings, your instincts, but give us the position from the moment the Anunnaki came to this planet. What do you think happened? I mean, how did they probably, I guess through their equipment and their technology, they knew that this planet was capable of having life until they got here. They probably didn't know what was here.
Yeah.
But give me, paint us a picture on what you think happened.
Well, look, I know that your listeners are very open-minded and are seeking more and more information. So I'm going to share something with you that I normally wouldn't share with people.
All right.
I went for a channeling recently. It was my first channeling ever, and I had a long chat with Enki himself. Now, I know a lot of people will say, yeah, I don't know, you don't quite know who you know, who's coming through and actually giving you the information and so forth. But it was, the information was so consistent with our discoveries and shone a light on much of the things we've been discovering and explained a lot of things that previously weren't, I was a little gray on. And it's very interesting. So the story is pretty much like Zachariah Sitchin sketches, and a few other authors have sketched in the past, is that the Anunnaki arrived here 400 odd thousand years ago, seeking gold. At that stage, they needed the gold for very simple reasons, for climatic problems on their own planet. It was only much later that they discovered the monatomic principles or properties of gold. Mm-hmm. And only then did they started using gold as a source of energy. They didn't know it when they first arrived and started mining the gold. So it's only much later, and I believe that real explosion in knowledge and technology happened after the flood of about 13,000 years ago, the biblical flood, but now I'm jumping a bit. So they came here, they're looking for gold. They found some gold in the Near East. They started mining that. And it wasn't enough.
And they were doing that themselves at that point,
That's right. They were doing that themselves, and it seems that also they were getting it from sea sand under the water, and from quartzite that's been broken up and sea sand, and they were getting gold out of that, and it wasn't enough. And then Enki took it upon himself, I believe it was Enki, possibly with the help of a few others. They scanned the planet Earth. They flew all over the place looking for more denser and higher deposits of gold, and they found it in southern Africa.
They sure did.
Yeah, they sure did. And then shortly after that, they moved the whole mining operation here to the south. Enki established himself a fortress, his headquarters, which is Great Zimbabwe Ruins. And when your listeners go onto our website, they should also see. I'm not sure if I loaded the aerial picture of Great Zimbabwe, but when you look at the aerial photographs of the stone circular structures and you see a picture of Great Zimbabwe from the air, you instantly see it's the same, exactly the same civilization, the same architects, the same group of people, except Great Zimbabwe is a lot bigger. As I mentioned earlier, it's the mine manager's house. And so he established his fortress there, and they carried on mining. And then they realized that they weren't getting enough gold. They needed help, because there were, 300 odd of them or something like that, maybe
something
600
like that.
At 600 at the most. That's what some of the scholars have come up with, those numbers. And that's just, if you think about gold mining processes, 600 people or 300 people is not going to get you a lot of gold out of the ground.
No. They were loading it onto their craft, right? And then taking off again, back and forth.
Taking it off the planet. Yeah.
All right.
And this is where it gets really interesting. When we get back to this giant settlement down here, the gold mining settlement, all the paths and the roadways that we've got here. But let's come back to that later. And so then they started mining. They were on their own. They needed help. And that's when they decided, look, we need help. We need to clone some sort of a robot or a species that is, not too advanced or intelligent to question us or argue with us. We need somebody that will just take instructions, be smart enough to understand instructions, operate some tools, and help us get the gold out of the ground. And I can tell you one thing. I've done a lot of geological research in the last 6 months, and it is not easy to find gold. Okay, I can now say that from personal experience.
Yeah.
Personal attempts to find gold in ore on the surface, and I've analyzed over probably 1,000 rocks and 1,000 sediments and things like that, geological structures. It is not easy to find gold. So when they found it, when they found the mother lode under the ground here in South Africa, they realized this is where they've got to go en masse and start doing it in big numbers. And that's exactly what happened. They then messed around for a while, planned, did some genetic experiments between themselves and between various other creatures.
And I bet in some cases, Michael, they probably failed miserably and made some incredibly horrible creatures.
Exactly. I mean, you've seen many movies and many stories that have been written about cross-pollinating different species and coming up with these horrible hybrid creatures. Well,
yes.
Those are probably very, very accurate. And my guess is that it's probably happening today. We don't know about it. It's probably, assigned to some black ops secret government project where they're cloning, breeding people with other creatures and seeing what they can come up with. And, believe me, it's probably happening.
Well, that so-called mythical creature Pan, who has the human body and torso, but he's got the goat legs or the sheep legs on the bottom with his cloven hoofs.
Yeah.
Maybe they made him,
Well, exactly. I mean, and according to some of the translations of the Sumerian tablets, that's exactly what they say, that they created these creatures. They crossed DNA of ape-like creatures, the Australopithecus, the Homo erectus. They crossed their DNA, and they found, they created horrible creatures that obviously were completely useless in an intelligent kind of productive environment. Or relatively productive environment of work and getting gold out of the ground.
When they finally honed in on us and created us in the image we are now, were we in their image?
That's what it seems like. It definitely seems like it. It was in their image. However, the Anunnaki are described to be tall and blue-eyed and blonde. The creature or the Homo sapiens they created was it might have been in their image, in their the sort of general physical anthropomorphic shape, and had a smooth skin like they did, but it was a reddish, a darker skin and a reddish skin. They call it red, like the soil of the color of the African soil. And I must tell you, I mean, I'm sure you got the same color in the United States, but you know, I've just come down from a mountain near the border of Botswana where I went to investigate this another section of this lost civilization, and it's all the same. I'm just finding all the same direct links, the same tools they were making, the same stone they were using. But when I was coming down the mountain, there was this disturbed soil, and the red color of that soil was just so striking and so rich that phrase from the Sumerian tablets just came to me loud and clear. You know, when Enki yeah. says, "I've made him in my image, in my like, in my image, and his color, the skin, of we've created the creature, and his hair was short and curly, and his skin was the color, the reddish, of the color of the African soil." And when I saw that color, it just came shouting back at me. And I remembered that whole thing, yeah.
Now, did they jumpstart the age of the workers, or did they have to wait 20 years before it became somewhat of an adult, and then they put the creature to work?
Yeah, that's, again, you see, these are the things that, once you start exploring these ruins and you realize that we're dealing with this first civilization on Earth, we're dealing with the lost city of Enki. This is it. We're right in the middle of it.
Oh, my God.
The vanished, the mysterious lost city of Enki. What everyone's been looking for decades and possibly millennia, right? Now we're right in the middle of it. And then you start thinking about the pragmatic and the physical processes that had to happen here. Okay, so now you've got to start cloning and creating this new species to help you work in the mines. Okay, well, how do you go about this? First of all, as we know, they bred them through their breeding surrogate mothers, and they kept popping them out. But now, that's not a very clever thing to do, is it?
Because you got to bring up. It's slow.
It's a very slow process. You got to first bring up the babies from screaming, changing their nappies. And, through the terrible twos and the horrible fours, and eventually when they get to the age of 16, you say, okay, well, now you got to leave your mother. You got to go work, be a slave in the mines.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not exactly the kind of situation you want. You don't want attachment by this new species to any kind of mother figure. And what struck me is that they must have had cloning tanks down here and actually cloned this new species up to into an adult stage. And that's exactly what we found. We found some of these stone ruins are of a very specific shape. And they like hexagonal, and I'm sure that you already, when you hear the word hexagonal, alarm bells start ringing, because the hexagon is a very powerful structure and a shape for the flow of energy, right?
Exactly, exactly.
So when you see these hexagonal kind of stone ruins that are not very big. They're probably about 2.5-3 meters across, if that. And mm-hmm. and they clustered together like a honeycomb. And it's spectacular. You go, what the hell is this for?
No, they could have had hundreds, if not thousands, of these cloning tubes. Right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what they had, George. They are hundreds and thousands of these little hexagonal chambers clustered together like honeycombs. And like a honeycomb. And if you think about it, you know, how do bees breed and ants and all that? You're looking like an ant's nest or a bee's nest where the little babies come out of, or where the bees come out of.
And in this case, they may have come out full-sized, maybe.
Full-sized. In fact, that's what I asked in my channeling. I said, you know, how long did it take to breed or to clone the workers from start to an adult size where they could come out and be immediately productive in the gold mine? And the answer was the normal full term. So we're looking at 9 months to clone from inception to fully cloned human being.
That's amazing. Now, why did they abandon the planet? Something happened.
Yeah, this is the big mystery here. And I tell you, The biggest mystery is not the fact that we have now found this giant city that is just so huge it boggles the mind. It makes Los Angeles and Johannesburg and London look like a joke.
Oh, my okay? God. It's that big?
Oh, much, much larger. Much, much, much larger. I'm talking about 10,000 square kilometers per city. Maybe we should just quickly go over the size of this, George.
Yeah, okay, yeah, let's do that, because we're going to spend another hour, next hour, talking about this, Michael, and then in the last hour, we're going to take phone calls. So,
excellent.
So go ahead, explain that.
Excellent. I'm going to take your listeners on a little journey. Let's quickly start with the estimates in the past, throughout history, how people have sort of come to know about these ruins and then estimated how many they were.
Okay.
Well, the brilliant Theodore Bent, who I mentioned earlier, who was the first guy to excavate Great Zimbabwe, in 1891, he estimated that there were about 4,000 of these stone structures. Now, remember, he was on foot. He was tracking through what was then a very dangerous part of the world. There were lions everywhere and wild animals. It was not an easy place to explore in those days, because you're always possible food for some creature somewhere. And then by 1974, there was a chap called Roger Summers who wrote about, I think, three or four books on the ruins of southern Africa. And he did a beautiful calculation, and he, at that stage, calculated that there were about 20,000 of these stone ruins in southern Africa. Now, already, 20,000 is a large number. Because remember, currently, our current history books tell us that southern Africa, until about 1,000 years ago, was extremely sparsely populated. There were only a few thousand people living here, and they were mostly hunter-gatherers.
Hmm.
Now, suddenly we get someone tells us there are 20,000 stone ruins, large circular stone structures. It already doesn't compute.
No, it doesn't. Something happened.
Something happened. And then Jan Heine started photographing this about 20 years ago, and realizing that there are many more than just 20,000 of these. I got involved with Jan in 2007, and we started really exploring this with great energy, and haven't stopped. By about a year ago, I estimated there were at least 100,000 of these ruins. I made a phone call to the ex-head of archaeology at Wits University, Professor Revel Mason. And when I asked him, Revel, you've been studying these ruins for a long time. How many do you think they were? And he just off the bat said, oh, there's at least 100,000 of these. And I went, that's fantastic, because that's exactly how many I think there are.
Sure.
There must be at least 100,000 of these ruins. And then I said to him, but that tells us that there must have been at least probably, a million or 2 million or 10 million people living here. And he went, oh, well, then that can't be 100,000. And you see what happens there is that our academics have
there's
a theory.
That,
and they
there's
try
that
and
reluctance
force,
right away.
Exactly. They try and force the evidence into their theory instead of taking the evidence and formulating a new theory based on your evidence.
Exactly.
Just like the guys in CSI do. I mean, the guys in CSI wouldn't get anywhere if they had a theory and trying to fit the evidence into their theory.
Have any other explorers in, in mass just gone down to that area to do some work?
No,
it's amazing that they've just left it. It's just there, huh?
No, the only two people that are doing any work on this is Jan Heine and myself, as incredible as it sounds. And I know it may come across as a bit arrogant, but that's what it is.
Why? Do you have helpers? You must.
No. No, we don't.
You've discovered one of the greatest finds of all mankind, and it's just the two of you there. That's incredible. Michael, we're already at the top of the hour. We're going to come back with more. I want to get into the Anunnaki. I want to get your take on why you think they left. Then we'll talk more about the ruins on Coast to Coast AM.